From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Arizona Supreme Court issued a ruling that creates a near total abortion ban in the state of Arizona. A ban with no exceptions for rape and incest. A ban that will apply to women before they even know they are pregnant. And threatens prison time for nurses and doctors.
Arizona's Supreme Court bars almost all abortions in the state by reviving an 1864 law passed before Arizona was a state and before women could even vote. We'll get the latest. Then President Biden calls Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's policies in Gaza a mistake.
Yes, I think what he's doing is a mistake. I don't agree with his approach. I think it's outrageous that those three vehicles were hit by drones and taken out.
We'll speak with Middle East analyst Muin Rabbani, and we'll be joined by two former Israeli soldiers, members of Breaking the Silence, an anti-occupation group led by veterans of the Israeli army. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In an historic ruling, Arizona's conservative Supreme Court has reinstated an 1864 law barring almost all abortions in the state. In its ruling, the court wrote, quote, "Physicians are now on notice that all abortions, except those necessary to save a woman's life, are illegal," unquote. The 160-year-old law predates Arizona becoming a state and was passed decades before women could even vote. While the court stayed its decision for 14 days, the ruling sent shockwaves across Arizona and the nation. President Biden slammed the ruling as extreme and dangerous. Arizona's Attorney General Chris Mays said she will not enforce it, saying, quote, "No woman or doctor will be prosecuted under this draconian law." Arizona's Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs vowed to protect abortion rights.
Arizona's 2022 abortion ban is extreme and hurts women. And the near total Civil War era ban that continues to hang over our heads only serves to create more chaos for women and doctors in our state. As governor, I promised I would do everything in my power to protect our reproductive freedoms.
Last week, the group Arizona for Abortion Access said it had collected enough signatures, over 500,000, to put a measure on the ballot in November to enshrine abortion rights in Arizona. Reproductive rights will also play a key role in Arizona's closely watched Senate race. Republican candidate Carrie Lake criticized the court's ruling Tuesday, even though just 2 years ago she called it a, quote, "great law." The Arizona ruling came just a day after Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump said abortion should be decided by the states. We'll have more on Arizona after headlines. President Biden's leveled some of his harshest criticism of Israel yet as the death toll in Gaza tops 33,300. In an interview with Univision, Biden directly criticized Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel's killing of 7 aid workers from World Central Kitchen last week.
Yes, I think what he's doing is a mistake. I don't agree with his approach. I think it's outrageous that those three vehicles were hit by drones and taken out on a highway where it wasn't like it was along the shore. It wasn't like there was a convoy moving here, et cetera. So what I'm calling for is for the Israelis to just call for a ceasefire, allow for the next 6-8 weeks total access to all food and medicine going into the country.
Biden's comments were made a week ago, but only aired on Univision on Tuesday. Palestinians in Gaza are making the end of Ramadan as Israel continues its assault. Officials in Gaza say at least 14 Palestinians, including 4 children, have died in Israeli strikes on the Nusayrat refugee camp. On Monday, Israel assassinated the mayor of the Al-Maghazi refugee camp. Hamas accused Israel of committing a war crime.
The Israeli occupation's army committed a crime yesterday with the assassination of Al-Maghazi municipal chief Hatem Saleh Al-Ghamri. He's known as a civilian, a municipal head, who provides municipal services since the first day of this war, this genocide against civilians and civil sectors. The Israeli occupation's army purposefully targeted Al-Ghamri, even though they are fully aware that he's a civil servant and only works within that framework at Al-Maghazi refugee camp.
On Capitol Hill, about 50 protesters were arrested Tuesday when they blocked access to the Senate cafeteria, calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Protesters also disrupted Lloyd Austin during a Senate hearing where the defense secretary was questioned by Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas.
I want to address what the protesters raised earlier. Is Israel committing genocide in Gaza?
Senator Cotton, we don't have any evidence of genocide being created.
So that's a no. Israel's not committing genocide in Gaza.
We don't have evidence of that, to
Thank
my
you.
Knowledge. Yeah.
That was Lloyd Austin speaking with Arkansas's Republican Senator Tom Cotton. Turkey's announced it will restrict exports to Israel until Israel declares a ceasefire in Gaza and allows in more aid. Israel blasted Turkey's decision, accusing it of blackmail. The first criminal trial of a former U.S. president appears set to begin Monday after Donald Trump lost his 10th attempt to delay the trial. But Trump's appeal could still be heard by a full panel of five appellate court judges. Trump's accused of falsifying business records to hide hush money payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election. In 2018, Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to making the payments for Trump and spent over a year in prison. The state of Missouri executed Brian Dorsey Tuesday despite a rare call by 70 prison guards and a former warden for his life to be spared. Dorsey was convicted in 2006 for murdering his cousin and her husband while high on drugs. He later turned himself in and pleaded guilty. Prison guards at the Potosi Correctional Center recently wrote to Missouri Governor Mike Parson urging him to commute Dorsey's death sentence. They cited his unblemished record in prison, during which time he became a popular barber who cut the hair both prisoners and staff. The guards wrote, quote, "He doesn't deserve to be executed. We know that he was convicted of murder, but that is not the Brian Dorsey that we know," unquote. In Michigan, the parents of Ethan Crumbly, who shot dead four classmates at Oxford High School in 2021, have been sentenced to between 10 and 15 years in prison. James and Jennifer Crumbly are the first parents to be held criminally responsible for a mass school shooting committed by their child. During the sentencing hearing, Nicole Beausoleil, the mother of Madison Baldwin, who died in the school shooting, addressed the Crumblys.
"You say you wouldn't do anything different. Well, that really says on what type of parents you are, because there's a lot of things I would do different. But the one thing I would have wanted to be different was to take that bullet that day so she could continue to live the life she deserved."
New York City's reached a $28 million settlement in a lawsuit brought forward by the family of a former Rikers prisoner who suffered severe brain damage after attempting to hang himself in his cell while guards watched without intervening. Nicholas Feliciano was 18 years old at the time and had a history of severe mental illness and previous suicide attempts. He was imprisoned at Rikers over a parole violation in late 2019 when he tried to hang himself while more than half a dozen guards stood by. They did not interfere until Feliciano became unconscious and limp. Three of the guards and a captain were charged with felonies in 2022. If approved, the settlement will be among the largest pretrial settlements ever awarded to a single plaintiff in a civil rights case in New York City. In Chicago, the family of Dexter Reed is calling for charges against the police officers who shot and killed Reed after a traffic stop last month. Newly released body cam video shows plainclothes Chicago police officers fired nearly 100 shots in just 41 seconds. It remains unclear why officers assigned to a tactical unit pulled over Reed, who was black, or why they approached his car with guns drawn. Police initially said Reed was pulled over because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, but Reed was driving in a car with tinted windows. Police claim the shootout began after Reed fired the first shot. And the railroad giant Norfolk Southern has agreed to pay $600 million to settle a class action lawsuit over last year's train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. The disaster led to a massive explosion, the release of toxic chemicals, including levels of dioxin hundreds of times higher than what's considered safe. Many local residents say they fear the settlement will not come close to covering future health care expenses. East Palestine resident Chrissy Ferguson criticized the settlement, saying, quote, I just feel like we've been victimized over and over and over again. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, in an historic ruling, Arizona's conservative Supreme Court has reinstated an 1864 law barring almost all abortions in the state. In its ruling, the court wrote, quote, physicians are now on notice that all abortions except those necessary to save a woman's life are illegal, unquote. The 160-year-old law predates Arizona becoming a state and was passed before women could even vote. While the court has stayed its decision for 14 days, the ruling sent shockwaves across Arizona and the nation. President Biden slammed the ruling as extreme and dangerous. Arizona's Attorney General Chris Mays said she will not enforce it, saying, quote, no woman or doctor will be prosecuted under this draconian law. Arizona's Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs vowed to protect abortion rights.
Arizona's 2022 abortion ban is extreme and hurts women. And the near total Civil War era ban that continues to hang over our heads only serves to create more chaos for women and doctors in our state. As governor, I promised I would do everything in my power to protect our reproductive freedoms.
Last week, the group Arizona for Abortion Access said it had collected enough signatures, over 500,000, to put a measure on the November ballot to enshrine abortion rights in Arizona. Reproductive rights will also play a key role in Arizona's closely watched Senate race. Republican candidate Carrie Lake criticized the court's ruling Tuesday, even though just 2 years ago she called it, quote, a great law. The Arizona ruling came just a day after Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump said abortion should be decided by the states. For more, we're joined by Amy Littlefield, abortion access correspondent at The Nation magazine. Amy, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the significance of this ruling in Arizona?
Good morning, Amy. And I just want to deeply apologize. I didn't have time to put on my whalebone corset and my hoop skirt this morning before appearing on television. I know there might be men watching. I hope the anti-vice squad doesn't come after me for disseminating information about abortion, which is what I'm about to do here. In all seriousness, though, I think what's become abundantly clear, both at the federal level and at the state level now in Arizona, is that the central strategy of the anti-abortion movement is to roll back the clock to the Victorian era, because they know that they cannot win through the democratic process, because abortion rights are popular. They always have been popular. But now the abortion rights majority in this country is mobilized and angry, and they know they can't win at the ballot box. And so they are combing through zombie laws from the 19th century to see if they can restrict abortion that way, which is not only anti-abortion, but deeply anti-democratic as well. So this is a law that is coming back into force in Arizona that dates back to a time before women could vote, that dates back to a time before slavery was ended, when, you know, Black women in large swaths of the country were still considered chattel. This dates back to an era where we had widespread regulation, not just of abortion, but of anything that was considered vice or, you know, immoral It dates back to an era where we had the Federal Comstock Act, right? In 1873, the Federal Comstock Act, which was used to restrict abortion, drugs, and devices through the mail. This law, you know, from 1873, which hasn't been enforced in many, many years, is now the central strategy of the anti-abortion movement at the federal level. They're trying to bring it back into force to create a nationwide anti-abortion ban because, of course, again, they can't win in the court of public opinion. So we're seeing this also in Florida, another state that recently had a really important abortion ruling that could lead to the instatement May 1st of a 6-week ban in that state, where justices on the conservative Supreme Court in that state seem to be flirting with the idea that personhood for fetuses and embryos is protected under the Florida Constitution. The key caveat here, of course, is that we're going to see abortion on the ballot in Arizona and Florida, and so the people are going to have their say. I want to just make one more important point, Amy, which is abortion is still, this ruling is not in effect in Arizona. The Florida ruling is also not in effect yet, which means that Florida abortion is still legal up to 15 weeks. Arizona abortion clinics, as far as I know, as of this moment, are still providing services. And so you can go to ineedana.com or plancypills.org to find up-to-date information about access to abortion, regardless of where you live.
And Amy, what do you make of the statements, the public statements of the Attorney General in Arizona, Chris Mays, and of the governor in direct opposition to the court's decision? What do you think is going to be the impact? As you were mentioning, there will likely be a ballot question now in Arizona on abortion. What do you think will be the impact on turnout and the central question of abortion in this upcoming election?
Absolutely. I mean, Arizona activists were already working on a ballot initiative to protect the right to abortion in that state. Florida activists have also cleared hurdles to put the question of abortion rights on the ballot in that state. We're going to see it on the ballot in other states, too, where the stakes aren't quite as high. And, you know, this could swing the election. Right. I mean, there's no question. The Biden administration, the Biden campaign started paying attention to Florida, started buying ads in Florida right after the court decision, reviving the 6-week ban there. Arizona was already considered a battleground state. So there's no question that Democrats are banking on this being a huge way to lift their boats in the next election. I mean, the key caveat there is, look, if Democrats want to win on the issue of abortion, I think they're going to have to start listening to reproductive justice activists who are saying, number one, what's going on in Gaza right now is a reproductive justice issue. And if you are going to be an administration that claims to support, you know, reproductive rights and justice, you cannot support what's going on with the Israeli bombardment of Gaza right now. And number two, they need to repeal the Comstock Act. Again, we could see a replication of what's happening in Arizona at the federal level. This is not a pro-life movement. This is a pro-zombie movement. And they are trying to bring back these zombie laws from the 19th century. And if it can happen in Arizona, it can happen at the federal level if the Comstock Act comes back into force. And we saw recently in arguments before the Supreme Court that at least two justices on the Supreme Court seem very eager to bring the Comstock Act back into effect and roll this entire country back to the Victorian era.
Do you feel hopeful when you see the response of Republicans in Arizona? I mean, you have Carrie Lake, who hailed this law 2 years ago, now saying it was a bad decision. You have former Governor Ducey, who appointed 5 of the 7 state Supreme Court justices who made this decision to go back 150 years, saying it wasn't a good decision. Carrie Lake, of course, going up against Ruben Gallego for the Senate race. He's already raising this as a major issue.
Yes, Amy, I feel nothing short of sheer delight when I see Republicans running from this issue in that way. I mean, they understand the writing is on the wall. Abortion was popular before the Dobbs decision, right? A majority, overwhelming majority of the population wants abortion to be legal in all circumstances. That was true. That's been true for many years. After Dobbs, That population is angry. They are motivated. They are voting. They are organizing. And Republicans and Democrats alike understand this. So I'm not surprised to see Republicans running from this issue, backtracking on their own, you know, anti-abortion statements, trying to hide from, you know, anyone who wants to ask them questions about that. Again, I think this is the sleeping giant of the pro-abortion rights majority in this country has been awakened. We saw that in Kansas right after the Dobbs decision, right, where this ruby red state, you know, voted to protect abortion rights in the state. And so I think, you know, that's, again, a reason for Democrats to be very encouraged and Republicans to be very discouraged in states like Arizona and Florida, where abortion is likely going to be directly on the ballot. But again, Democrats can't just coast to victory on that, right? If they're gonna purport to be the candidate that represents the reproductive health rights and justice movement, they've got to start listening to that movement's demands.
Interestingly, Vice President Kamala Harris is headed to Tucson on Friday to give a speech on this issue. Amy Littlefield, want to thank you for being with us, abortion access correspondent at The Nation magazine. When we come back, Israeli airstrikes continue in Gaza on the first day of Eid, and there's been little increase in humanitarian aid being allowed in. We'll be joined by Middle East analyst Muin Rabbani. Stay with us.
يا قدس يا قدس يا قدس يا مدينة الصلاة أصلي عيوننا إليك ترحل كل يوم ترحل كل يوم تدور
Flower Among Cities, Aret el-Madain by Feruz. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. President Biden called Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's policies in Gaza a mistake and urged Israel to call for a temporary ceasefire to allow in more aid. Biden's comments came in an interview that aired Tuesday on the Spanish-language TV network Univision. In his remarks, Biden highlighted the Israeli airstrike last week on an aid convoy that killed 7 aid workers with the food charity World Central Kitchen, 6 of those aid workers international.
I think what he's doing is a mistake. I don't agree with his approach. I think it's outrageous that those three vehicles were hit by drones and taken out on a highway where it wasn't like it was along the shore. It wasn't like there was a convoy moving here, et cetera. So what I'm calling for is for the Israelis to just call for a ceasefire, allow for the next 6-8 weeks total access to all food and medicine going into the country. I've spoken with everyone from the Saudis to the Jordanians to the Egyptians. They're prepared to move in. They're prepared to move this food in. And I think there's no excuse to not provide for the medical and the food needs of those people. They should be done now.
Following the airstrike on the World Central Kitchen convoy last week, Biden called Netanyahu and warned for the first time the U.S. would be forced to change its policy if Israel did not change its policies in Gaza. Israel responded by pledging to open new aid crossings. However, the U.N. said Tuesday there's been, quote, no significant change in the volume of humanitarian supplies entering Gaza, unquote. And the Biden administration has not actually changed its policies or withheld any arms transfers to Israel. This comes as Human Rights Watch is calling on governments to impose targeted sanctions on Israel and suspend arms transfers to press the Israeli government to ensure access to humanitarian aid. The rights group has accused the Israeli government of using starvation as a weapon of war. At least 32 people, including 28 children, have died of malnutrition and dehydration in northern Gaza, where famine is setting in. In the south, at least 5% of children under age 2 were found to be acutely malnourished. Meanwhile, Israeli airstrikes continue across Gaza, including dozens of strikes in Gaza City, as well as in central Gaza, where an airstrike hit a home in the Nusayrat refugee camp today, killing at least 14 people, including 5 children. For more, we're joined by Middle East analyst Muin Rabbani. He's an editor of Jedalia and host of the Connections podcast. He's a contributor to the new book, Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. He was previously a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us here in studio in New York. I wanted to start off with a clip yesterday. Foreign Minister, British Foreign Minister David Cameron, stood with Secretary of State Antony Blinken at a news conference. They were at the State Department. Cameron said Britain's position on arms sales to Israel was unchanged.
The latest assessment leaves our position on export licenses unchanged. This is consistent with the advice that I and other ministers have received, and as ever, we will keep the position under review. Let me be clear, though, we continue to have grave concerns around the humanitarian access issue in Gaza, both for the period that was assessed and subsequently.
And then you have Blinken and Cameron shaking hands. Can you talk about what President Biden is saying, what's happening on the ground in Gaza, and why what the U.S. does matters, not to mention Britain saying they're continuing arms sales?
Well, President Biden referred to Israeli policy towards the Gaza Strip as a mistake. I mean, a mistake is when you take a wrong turn at a traffic light, or perhaps when a surgeon removes the wrong kidney. But when over the course of 6 months, half a year, you kill tens of thousands of people, with perhaps additional tens of thousands buried under the rubble and decomposing, that's not a mistake. That's a deliberate policy, and that's why Israel has been hauled in front of the International Court of Justice on charges of genocide. I think the second issue here is that words are cheap and statements are a dime a dozen, and Israel over the decades has learned that it can safely ignore statements, whether by U.S. or European decision makers, that are essentially playing to the gallery. Because what really matters is not what these people say, but what they do. And when the United States, United Kingdom, the European Union indicate that there is not going to be any consequences, that Israel will continue to be allowed to act with impunity, that there will be no consequences for Israel's actions, then Israel's leaders, whether Netanyahu or any of his predecessors, know that they can safely ignore statements such as the ones we've been hearing.
Muin Rabbani, I wanted to ask you, the UN Security Council is going to make a formal decision on Palestine's bid for full UN membership this month. But the U.S. Will likely veto this if it is approved. And the U.S. is saying that Palestine needs to negotiate statehood with Israel before it is granted statehood by the U.N. Your response to this, since obviously when Israel was admitted into the U.N., the Palestinians were not asked to first negotiate Israel's statehood.
Well, I think the U.S., despite several statements over the years to the contrary, has had a consistent position against Palestinian self-determination, against Palestinian statehood. It has recently voted against several resolutions in the UN General Assembly reaffirming the inalienable right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. And essentially what the U.S. government is saying is that it will not support Palestinian statehood unless Israel does so. And Israel's position is crystal clear on this matter. It rejects Palestinian statehood. So in other words, the U.S. is subcontracting its position on Palestinian statehood to Israel and adopting it as its own.
I also wanted to ask you about Prime Minister Netanyahu claiming that the date is set for the attack on Rafah, but at the same time, Palestinians are being allowed to return to Khan Yunis after Israel basically destroyed that city. Your response to that?
I think that's a situation that is a little unclear, because both the United States and the Europeans have come out against an Israeli ground operation in Rafah. Netanyahu has claimed the date for that operation has already been set. His defense minister, Yoav Gallant, has said that no such date has been set. Netanyahu has also been saying that if Israel does not enter Rafah, it will not be able to win this war. And this may be a maneuver by Netanyahu to essentially claim that it is because of the United States and it is because of the Europeans and their opposition to an operation in Rafah that Israel's military campaign in the Gaza Strip has failed, and then also to use these differences with the U.S. for domestic political reasons.
Mouin Rabbani, can you talk about what's going on in Cairo right now, the negotiations between Hamas and Israel? Can you talk about the prisoners and the hostages? I know that's being debated. I mean, I think in the West Bank, it's something like 8,000 people have been taken prisoner, many of them children, since October 7th. And you have something like 130 hostages, Israeli and other foreign nationals, taken by Hamas and other groups on October 7th. And then the whole issue of a ceasefire and letting aid in.
Yes, there are a number of issues that are being negotiated. One of them is an exchange of captives. Another is, and for that, formulas are being discussed about how many Palestinian captives Israel will release in exchange for the Palestinians releasing the Israeli and other captives in the Gaza Strip. A second concerns a ceasefire, whether it will be temporary or permanent. And Hamas and Palestinians are of course, insisting that a temporary pause in fighting, during which there's an exchange of captives and then this genocidal assault resumes, it doesn't really make sense. A third issue is an Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. And a fourth, and apparently the most important sticking point, is whether or not Palestinians who have been displaced, primarily from the northern Gaza Strip, many of whom are now in the Rafah region, will be allowed to return to whatever is left or their former homes. And in fact, it is on this issue that, according to reports, Israel is proving the most obstinate. It has stated that it would allow women and children, but not military-aged men, to return to the northern Gaza Strip. The Palestinians are insisting that such return be unrestricted. And there is apparently now a proposal where Israel would withdraw from this barrier that it established to bisect the Gaza Strip, and that it would be manned by Egyptian forces to ensure that no armed men would go from the southern to the northern Gaza Strip. Whether this is something that will be accepted by both parties remains to be seen. But it's interesting that of all these issues we've been hearing about, it is actually Israeli opposition to the return of displaced refugees to the northern Gaza Strip that is proving to be the main sticking point.
What's Israel's goal in all of this?
I believe it's to make the Gaza Strip unfit for human habitation. Of course, Israel entered this war hoping and intending to eradicate and eliminate Hamas as a government and as an armed force, and thought it could do so within a matter of weeks, if not a few months. That has proven to be an abject failure. But I think there's a wider objective here, that it had an almost insatiable lust for revenge after October 7th. It wanted to make an example out of the Gaza Strip in order to deter Palestinians or any of its surrounding adversaries from ever considering an attack on Israel like this again. And I think it also has a long-standing issue with the presence of so many Palestinians, particularly Palestinian refugees from 1948, on its border. This is a policy that goes back to the 1950s and has seen in this crisis, and more importantly in the unconditional Western support that has received since October 7th, to resolve its Gaza problem, if you will, to either displace the Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip or to make it unfit for human habitation.
And Muin, I wanted to ask you, there's a lead story in today's New York Times that's claiming that Iran has been flooding the West Bank with weapons in an effort to basically stoke an uprising of Palestinians on the West Bank. I'm wondering your sense of that, because the report doesn't talk much about all of the repression and attacks and killings of Palestinians that have been occurring in the West Bank, especially since the October 7th attack by Hamas.
Well, there's a reason people refer to the New York Times as American Pravda. In this particular report, there's virtually no evidence of any significant Iranian arms deliveries to the West Bank. And when you consider how limited Iranian arms deliveries to the Gaza Strip have been, it doesn't really make sense to believe that there are significantly more weapons being delivered to a territory that is under much more intensive Israeli control. And again, you know, there's been this decades-long attempt to seek to show the Palestinians as somehow not having any legitimate grievances of their own, as always acting on behalf of someone else's agenda rather than on behalf of their own rights and interests. You know, it used to be they used to be Soviet proxies, then they became jihadists, now they're Iranian proxies. Who knows what they'll be tomorrow? But even if Iran didn't exist, this conflict and this Palestinian struggle for freedom and liberation would be essentially be undiminished. And, you know, this particular article makes a lot of claims, but provides virtually no evidence to substantiate those claims.
Talk about what Israel did in Damascus, bombing the Iranian consulate. Now they've reopened one there.
Yes.
And what exactly is going on? We're hearing all kinds of reports that Iran and the U.S. have made a deal that if the U.S. gets a ceasefire in Gaza, that Iran won't attack U.S., which is arming Israel. We hear GPS is turned off in Israel so that Iran can't attack Israel.
Yes. Well, in contrast to many previous Israeli attacks on Iranian targets in Syria, this one targeted the Iranian consulate in Damascus, which is sovereign Iranian territory, and the Iranians have indicated that from their point of view, the response would need to be direct rather than through, for example, allied militias, and that from their point of view, they would launch an attack directly from Iranian territory onto Israeli territory. Apparently, according to news reports, the Iranians have made an offer to the Americans, which is that if the Americans impose a permanent ceasefire and put an end to this genocidal Israeli assault at the Gaza Strip, that will be considered a closure of the file. Also because I think the Iranians and many others, for that matter, believe that it's an Israeli ambition to further escalate this war regionally and seek to draw the Americans into a direct confrontation with Iran. It's a little unclear. I mean, we've seen indications from the Americans that this is something they're considering, but thus far, at least, we haven't seen confirmation that they are actually going to act on this proposal and impose a ceasefire.
Yeah, I wanted to get back for a moment to the negotiations over a ceasefire. We keep hearing in the U.S. press that the holdup is Hamas not not agreeing to the conditions of a deal that's already on the table. I'm wondering your thoughts about this, because it seems to me that it's much more in the interest of Israel to continue not having a ceasefire while it continues to conduct its operations rather than Hamas.
That's correct. And I think we also need to recognize that when we hear the term American proposal, what we're really talking about is an American proposal that has been closely coordinated and approved by Israel. So it's essentially an American communicated Israeli proposal. And there, as we were discussing previously, there are fundamental elements of this proposal that are unacceptable not only to Hamas, but to Palestinians generally. The idea that you would have a 6 to 8 week pause in fighting, and then this genocidal assault would resume in full force, is, I think, completely nonsensical. The idea of Palestinian men not being allowed to return to their former homes in the Gaza Strip, that Israel would still continue to have control over the delivery of aid to the Gaza Strip. And so these are all issues that are under discussion. But as we've seen in the aftermath of the Israeli killings of the World Central Kitchen staff, it literally takes only a phone call from the White House to resolve these issues. And so I think it's fair to assume that if the United States really wanted a ceasefire, it would only take another phone call. And the absence of that phone call, I think, is also a policy statement from Washington.
I wanted to go to that Lloyd Austin hearing in the Senate,
yes,
where the conservative Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton was questioning the U.S. Defense Secretary. This is protesters were being taken out of the room, calling for ceasefire. I think something like 50 people were arrested in the Senate cafeteria calling for ceasefire. This is Cotton questioning Austin.
I want to address what the protesters raised earlier. Is Israel committing genocide in Gaza?
Senator Cotton, we don't have any evidence of genocide being created.
So that's a no. Israel's not committing genocide in Gaza.
We don't have evidence of that,
to my
knowledge. Yeah.
We don't have evidence of Israel committing genocide in Gaza. Your final response as we begin to wrap up.
Well, Cotton had a similar incident with CIA Director William Burns a few weeks ago, and he failed to get a clear response from Burns. Here, of course, you have Secretary of Defense essentially not wanting to implicate himself in his department. So it was kind of an obvious answer for Lloyd Austin to give.
Muin Rabbani, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jedalia, host of the Connections podcast, contributor to the new book, Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. Muin Rabbani was previously senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. Coming up, we'll be joined by two former Israeli soldiers, members of Breaking the Silence, an anti-occupation group led by veterans of the Israeli army. Stay with us.
Feeling like it's utterly hopeless. How much more can we take?
How much more?
Everything Is Everything by Sinkane featuring True Osborne. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. The official death toll in Gaza has topped 33,400, including over 14,000 children, with over 76,000 people wounded. Over 1.7 million Palestinians have been displaced, around 70% of Gaza's population, while famine is setting in. The International Court of Justice has ruled there's plausible case Israel's committing genocide in Gaza. Meanwhile, violence by Israeli soldiers and settlers against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank has also exploded, with over 450 Palestinians killed in the last 6 months and at least 14 villages and towns forcibly depopulated. Among those speaking out against the violence are Israeli soldiers themselves. Breaking the Silence is an anti-occupation group led by veterans of the Israeli army. The group was founded in 2004, 20 years ago, in the aftermath of the Second Intifada. We're joined right now by two members of Breaking the Silence. Nadav Weiman is the group's deputy director. He served in the West Bank and Gaza from 2005 to 2008. And Tal Sagi is the group's education director. She served as a soldier in Hebron, one of the largest cities in the West Bank. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Nadav, let's begin with you. Why are you in the United States and then headed to Canada? And your reaction as you listen to these numbers mounting in Gaza, where you were an Israeli soldier, though albeit many years ago, over 33,000 Palestinians dead.
Yeah, so we're over here to speak about what is happening in Gaza and in the West Bank, because we believe that what is happening in the West Bank, it's not a secret that belongs to us as soldiers. It's something that the international community should know, because the international community is a part of it. And we saw the discourse happening over here in the States about what is happening in Israel and Palestine, and that's why we did a campus tour. In the last 2 weeks, that was here with me, spoke in a lot of campuses all around, met a lot of students, because the conversation about the occupation happens everywhere, right? And we, as former soldiers, we want to be a part of it. And saying supporting Israel is not supporting the occupation. Supporting Israel is supporting peace for Israelis and Palestinians.
And Tal, talk about your experience in the military and why you chose to be a part of Breaking the Silence, and how many former Israeli soldiers or even current ones do you feel share your point of view? Occupation, I have to say, in the U.S. media is actually rarely talked about right now.
So it's not only here. We're not talking about it either. And actually, I grew up in a settlement in the West Bank, and I served in Hebron in the West Bank. And while serving, I was a tour guide. I used to take groups of soldiers for tours in the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron. And I didn't know what occupation is while taking these tours in this huge Palestinian city, surrounded by soldiers, and there are settlements in the middle of the city, and I didn't know that the city is under military control while I'm taking part of this military control, while I'm a settler myself. I didn't know where is the green line on what, or what is the green line, or anything about these things. So it took me a lot of time to realize that, but the fact that I didn't know that is not a mistake. We don't know these things as Israelis. We are not. We never taught these things because, you know, it's something that for years we're taking part of and we're doing, and we don't want to stop controlling millions of lives of Palestinians for so many. We're doing it for so many years, and we don't want to stop because we want to make sure that we have the control over the land. And we see now also how we don't have any other future. That's all we get. We've been told that this is security and we have to control millions of lives and we don't have other options. And we're trying to say that there are other options. But it's really hard to say to the Israeli society because we don't know that there are other options.
And Tal, you said that you didn't know that you were participating in the occupation. What were you taught in school in Israel about the Arabs and the Palestinians around you?
So I knew Palestinians from the other side of the fence. The settlement that I grew up in was surrounded by fences separating the settlement from the Palestinian villages around us. And I knew that they're not allowed to go into the settlement. I knew that I can go into the Palestinian village. And we never had any interaction, even though we lived so close to one another. And I could see everything that is happening in the other side of the fence and hear everything that is happening there. And I knew that they are my enemies. I knew that they all want to kill us. That was the only thing I knew about Palestinians. And we call them Arabs, like they're all one big Arabs and like one big enemy. So that was the only thing I knew about them.
And Nadav Weidman, I wanted to ask you, what's been the reception that you've received on the, especially on the college campuses, given the fact that that any discussions about Israel and Palestine have been so charged in recent months? Not only the reception from the students, but from the administrations at these various colleges.
You know, Nadav couldn't hear you, Juan, but Juan's question to you was, what is the reception of the students and the administrators in all the college campuses? You've organized this with J Street. Talk about what kind of reception you've gotten.
Yeah, so it was quite interesting because our lecture managed to bring together Israeli students that came to study here in the U.S., Jewish American students, and also Palestinian Americans. And I think that when you speak about the reality firsthand, right, we did it. We stood in checkpoints. We raided homes. We attacked Gaza from the air. We fought from the ground. So when you bring reality, you bring a real conversation about the occupation, and you bring a real conversation about Gaza. So the responses were quite amazing. There was really in-depth question and very interesting conversation around what is happening now, but what the future holds for us. And also, very important, what the U.S. can do to stop the war at the moment and to release our hostages and to enter as much humanitarian aid as possible to stop the humanitarian crisis and the starvation in Gaza at the moment. So the responses was very, very good, I've got to say.
So let me ask you about what has been the response since October 7th to breaking the silence, your group of former soldiers in Israel speaking out on behalf of both of Palestinians and those who are anti-occupation within Israel.
So from the very beginning of after October 7th, I've got to say October 7th was for an Israeli activist against the occupation was very hard. You know, yes, I ran with my children and my wife to the shelter in Tel Aviv, but immediately we start call to all of our testifiers, activists, donors in the Gaza envelope. And eventually some of them didn't answer, and two of them were murdered on October 7th. And one of them was a very good friend of mine. And this is how we started, right? You know, the blood was boiling, everybody was angry. But then on October 8th, we became a revenge army, and we started the airstrikes in Gaza. And of course, that we're breaking the silence, we know how it works, right? We know how airstrike looks like. We know how fighting in Gaza looks like. So after a couple of weeks, we and other NGOs in Israel, we called for ceasefire to release our hostages, to enter humanitarian aid into Gaza. And obviously, the right wing in Israel is against it because the right wing in Israel believes that we need to continue fighting. And I don't even understand the goals of the fighting now in Gaza. I think the number one goal is to release our hostages. So, yes, there was some aggression against breaking the silence. But in a couple of months, when we publish our report with the hundreds of testifiers that would come to us, then we expect another wave of violence. Mm.
I wanted to go to Tal Mitnick. In January, the 18-year-old who refused Israeli military service was sentenced to 30 days in a military prison. Democracy Now! Spoke with Tal after he was released about what he witnessed while incarcerated. He then went right back into prison.
Actually, inside prison, the only source of news that we got was one newspaper called Israel Hayom. And every day on the newspaper, there will be pictures of the soldiers that died. And I remember feeling like I feel sad, very sad for the soldiers and the families that have to take this great burden of losing someone close to them. But I know that while seeing soldiers dying, I know that this means that there are much more Palestinian civilians dying, which we don't see in the newspaper.
Who else are you serving time with in that prison? Who else is there?
Sadly, a lot of the other people there they are deserters, which means that they serve time in the military, and then at some point, for some reason, they went back home and did not come back. Most of these people desert because of socioeconomic reasons, if it's having to take care of their siblings or go work for their family. And when they come back and turn themselves in, we're now seeing a very heavy sentencing of those deserters as a part of the fascist persecution and the fog of war. People that went to work for 3 months to feed their family are now being sentenced to half a year in military prison.
So that was Tal Metnick, 18 years old, has been sentenced and sentenced again to military prison. How common is it for a soldier to say no, or refusnik, as you call them?
Not common at all. I served in the Israeli Special Forces. We were 12 in my team. I served in a sniper's team. And standing in front of your friends in mid-operation or before operation and say, hey, no, we have to stop because it's against the Fourth Geneva Convention or it's against the international human law, it really doesn't happen. Because a unit, doesn't matter if it's a platoon, a company, or a team, it's a family. And standing in front of your family members, your brother, saying no, it is very hard. This young man that did it before his army service, I think it's quite unique in the Israeli army, in the Israeli society. We have a couple of those each year, but the general soldiers and general public, they go to the army as they were requested by the State of Israel.
And Nadav Weinman, you served in the IDF in both Gaza and the West Bank. Could you talk about your experiences there and how you how that shaped your views of the occupation?
Yeah, so I served between 2005 to 2008 in a special forces unit. And me and my team served just after the Second Intifada. But when the IDF really pressured the Palestinian population like we are in the Second Intifada, so we arrested a lot of people. We searched for all kinds of things. But mainly we did sniping operations. Now, when you want to do sniping operation inside Palestinian cities or villages, you don't have a hill or a forest to take cover in. So what we used to do, it's something that is called Straw Widow. It's a code name in the IDF of taking a private Palestinian family's house and turn it into a military post. You choose a house that looks best for you. Maybe it's tall, maybe it has big windows. Then you call the Shin Bet. You make sure that every one of the family members are innocent, are not connected to terror. And then, in the middle of the night, you come, you sneak into the neighborhood, you break the door down, you grab everybody from their bed, because then they cannot really resist you, put them in one room, and then use one of the rooms, the parents' bedroom, for example, as our sniping post. We put our sniping rifles. And after that, if one of the family members wants to eat, they want to drink, they want to take medicine, they want to pray, they need authorization from us because it's our house, it's not their house anymore. And then you shoot from their houses. The minute you do that, the armed convoy come and you go back to the base. But that's the West Bank. In Gaza, when I did the same thing, straw widows in Gaza in 2008, you don't infiltrate, you don't do it quietly in the middle of the night. When we approached the houses, the first row of houses of Gaza, after cutting the fence and walking over there, a tank came and rammed one of the walls of the house and knocked it down, because they told us that every house in Gaza is booby-trapped. And then when we got inside the house, we took all of the men, from 16-year-old until 80-years-old, and we put them on a truck, drove them back to Israel for interrogation. And then, when we put our sniping rifles on the rooftop, we saw there's lots of new greenhouses that we didn't saw in the aerial photograph. So we called the D9 bulldozer that smashed everything down, so we will have a clean line of fire. And I think that's the difference between the ongoing occupation with settlements and checkpoints in the West Bank and the occupation by siege that we have in Gaza since 2007, and the level of brutality or firepower that we use over there.
Well, there's clearly a lot to talk about here. We're going to ask you to stay for a few minutes for a post-show. Nadav Vayman is deputy director of Breaking the Silence. Tal Sagi is education director. They're on a tour on college campuses around the United States and Canada, making their way to the Canadian Parliament. That does it for our show. I want to wish David Prude a happy birthday. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for a digital fellowship. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzda, Sharifa Belkadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Wernoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astigio, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!